Today on Straight Talk Africa, a review of some major political developments that shaped 2019 and a look ahead at issues that could impact the mother continent in 2020. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are talking about political events and economic developments that are likely to shape Africa in 2020. In 2019, there were many notable moments in African politics, from Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, to Sudan's longtime leader Omar al-Bashir being overthrown. My colleague Paul Ndiho has this review of Africa in 2019.
The year started with Felix Tshisekedi being sworn in as the Democratic Republic of Congo's president, marking the country's first ever peaceful handover of power after multiple bitterly disputed elections. Elsewhere, tens of millions of Africans used the ballot box to strengthen the quality of democratic governance. Incumbent presidents Macky Sall of Senegal and Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria easily won re-election. In South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa was sworn in as president for the first term. And in Malawi, President Peter Mutharika was sworn in for a second term after a contentious election marred by allegations of fraud and vote rigging. In Sudan, a new era is underway. Abdel Fattah al-Burhan is the new chairman of Sudan's recently formed Sovereign Council, after former President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in April 2019. A Sudanese court convicted al-Bashir on corruption charges in December and sentenced him to 2 years in detention in a reform facility.
There is still political unrest in South Sudan, but in a dramatic gesture at the Vatican, Pope Francis knelt to kiss the feet of South Sudanese leaders, President Salva Kiir and his former deputy turned opposition leader Riek Machar, urging them to find a peaceful solution to their differences.
The death in September of longtime Zimbabwean leader Robert Mugabe marked an end of an era. Mugabe was hailed as an independence war hero, but by the time of his death, he was widely seen as an oppressive ruler whose policies destroyed one of Africa's most prosperous nations. Mugabe was forced out in November 2017 after 37 years at the helm.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was honored with the Nobel Peace Prize in December at a ceremony in Norway for his peacemaking efforts with longtime enemy Eritrea. Since taking power in 2018, Abiy Ahmed has implemented sweeping political reforms that not only won him praise but lifted the lid on long-time repressed tensions between Ethiopia's many ethnic groups.
On the economic front, African leaders launched a continental free trade area. The $3.4 trillion economic bloc aims to boost cross-border trade and usher in a new era of economic development. The free trade agreement officially started on May 30th. Rwanda leads the scoreboard on foreign direct investment. Uganda launched its own airline in 2019.
While Kenya, one of the more stable economies, joined the club of oil exporters as it shipped its first crude oil export.
There were some setbacks on the continent. Xenophobia attacks in South Africa against foreigners are targeted mainly African immigrants. Africa also faced challenges in its health sector in 2019. Efforts to contain the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo continues as the country battles its second worst outbreak after one that claimed over 11,000 lives between 2013 and 2016.
In sports, Hajara Mijeje is a Tanzanian woman whose ball juggling skills sparked a viral video that also caught the attention of US President Donald Trump.
She is now traveling around Africa, wooing crowds and charging for performances to help her feed her family. South Africa's Springboks won the 2019 Rugby World Cup Championship. This was one of the sports highlights of the year. And finally, Kenyan marathoner world record holder Eliud Kipchoge made history in October by becoming the first person to run a marathon in under 2 hours in a controlled event in Vienna's Pareto Park.
The 35-year-old completed 26.2 miles in 1 hour, 59 minutes and 40 seconds. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us today in Washington are two distinguished guests, Catherine Kanavahita Guma, a fellow at the National Endowment for Democracy here in Washington, D.C., and executive director of the Development Network of Indigenous Voluntary Associations in Uganda. Richmond Danso, a doctoral candidate and teaching associate at the Department of Political Science of Howard University here in Washington, D.C. And in New York, we are joined by Yetunde Odubesan Omede, professor of global affairs at politics at Farmingdale State College. And from London, we have Dr. Joel Kibazo, a former senior executive with the African Development Bank. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the four of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, and I also think that wishing you a hugely prosperous 2020 and whatever else you wish for yourselves is in order.
Wish you the same too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then you come.
Thank you. Same to you.
Yeah, let me come to you immediately, Catherine. You come from Uganda. Not only do you come from Uganda, the last time I checked, I think, in fact, you are my neighbor in Kabale.
Sure.
And you also happen to, interestingly, to be a daughter of someone that was very, very important in my life.
Oh, great.
Mr. Kanavahita was my primary six teacher at Kigezi High School Primary in Kabale. So it's really an honor and a pleasure to be able to at least interact with his daughter here in the Washington studios.
Thank you, Shaka. It's my pleasure.
You're most welcome.
He's very proud of you.
You're most welcome. Now, let me ask you a very simple question. And I expect a very brief answer. What was your impression of the year that has just been reviewed by my colleague Paul Ndiho? How, in your view, did Africa fare?
I think Africa inspires a lot of hope and optimism. 2019 was a year that raised our high expectations in our own people.
Mm-hmm.
Remembering where we've come from as Africans,
mm-hmm.
and seeing where we are going,
mm-hmm.
and seeing the achievements,
mm-hmm.
winning the sports in the sports arena, winning the global awards, winning young people going on the street to demand for their rights and the freedoms, seeing dictators fall, seeing, I mean, this is really where we want to focus as Africans.
Dictators,
so
at least one
Bashir,
was removed,
yes,
in Sudan.
In Sudan. So we have a lot of hope. 2019 really mm-hmm. ended the decade
mm-hmm.
in a manner that inspires us to think that the next 2020 and beyond is going to be great for Africa.
What about you, Richmond?
Oh, I think I side with her to a large extent. It was very eventful, and most of the political activities taking place on the continent, I mean, So far, so good. It looked very good for us, and we can only hope and pray that things will get better with time. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done, but I think 2019 was pretty good for Africans.
What about you, Dr. Yetunde? What impressed you most?
I think 2019, as we know, it was really the year of return for a lot of displaced, individuals, refugees, and those who, you know, have a connection to the African continent. So we saw a surge of a lot of people all over the world coming back to African countries to basically find what their roots are. And I'm happy that Ghana in itself actually also held that, and other countries followed suit. So in addition to, of course, there were a lot of eventful things that have happened on the continent, both good and both bad. But I know that the trajectory for Africa as a whole in 2020 hopefully will be a bright and prosperous one.
You must be referring to the African diaspora, which, lives outside of the African continent, and especially North America,
yes,
the islands, and what have you. Why would you refer to them as refugees?
Well, not them particularly as refugees, but what we have seen is that we've seen a number of those who have, one, we have the African diaspora, which is one category. We do have refugees who have left the country to find, you know, either for economic reasons or were fleeing from political persecution. Some of them have returned back to various African countries in a way to further establish themselves and try to find ground. Although we still have a surge of them leaving the country and being placed in other parts around the world, but what we do have is what we call a return. And we're hoping that the conditions that are on ground in African countries allow those who have, one, not ever visited the African continent, or two, who have left the continent for various either religious, economic reasons, will return back to a healthier and more prosperous country.
I see. What about you, Joel?
Mm-hmm. I think a couple of things. I think on the economic front, you talked about the free trade area signing. Now, that is only a first step that has taken place, and it is something that has really been in the works for a long time. So for me, I thought that was quite significant. And, of course, the launch of the currency, the ECHO, that happened just last month, and we don't know when it will be fully in operation. But at least it shows that Africa is starting to get to grips with the aspect of the fact that you've got many states. Some are sort of economically sort of, and basically until you get that integration of Africa, these are the signs that are starting to happen in trade, in the currency. So basically that the continent is starting to get to grips with the reality of where it is, and starting to sort of engage with those very critical issues that will help development in the future. On the negative side, I think Ebola continues to be a real challenge. And in some cases, we saw a resurgence of things like HIV, which, of course, as you know, challenged Africa a while ago. But there are signs that there might be a sort of a return to some of those aspects. So for me, overall positive, but we do still face some challenges.
What about the issue of governance?
Well, the thing is this, that governance actually is one of those things that I'm not sort of one of these who's sort of terribly negative about governance in Africa, because examples have shown us that when people are ready, they know what to do. We saw this very clearly in Sudan, whereby a dictatorship that lasted for sort of 30 years was toppled with the determination. And the significance of Sudan was the fact that this was a movement led by young women. It was led by women. And so for me, I really think that, you know, whatever machinations governments may do or politicians may do, when the people are determined, they can do something about what shapes their lives.
Very interesting. Catherine, you, of course, heard that there are so many elections that took place on the continent in the year 2019.
Yes.
And yet, not all those elections really perhaps fit that description.
Mm.
because there were a lot of complaints that these were perhaps more selections than elections. By that I mean that people were told there is an election and eventually were actually taken through motions, because observers argue that normally a lot of those types of elections, you are talking about results which reflect not the will of the voter, the will of the people, but in fact reflect the will of the individual who announces the results, or the individuals who count the votes and have actually previously been appointed by incumbent presidents.
That's true.
That's true. Mm-hmm. So if true, what do you think needs to be done and must be done in order to make sure that a lot of African countries are in a position to develop the ability and the capacity to conduct free, fair, transparent, and credible elections?
Thank you for that question. It's a very valid question for especially Uganda, that is poised to have an election next year in 2021. And being my home country, I'm very passionately following what's happening. And as we know, we've had a president for the last 33 years, and who seems not to be willing to let go of power.
But he says he is the president for that long because the Ugandans love him.
We are yet to see whether we actually love him. If he opened up and had free and fair elections and had a leveled ground to compete with others. And as we talk now, we know that Honorable Robert Kyagulanyi, Member of Parliament, is not even allowed to consult in his own constituency. Monday he was arrested, and not even host concerts. He's also a musician. And you know what happens to Kizza Besigye, Honorable. So, basically, there is no free and fair elections in Uganda and many other countries. The incumbents use a lot of military force, use a lot of electoral violence, rigging, to ensure that they have life presidency. They have removed term limits and age limits from the constitution, and so it's all authoritarian rule and dictatorships.
So why does it seem then as if people accept the results? Are they willing victims?
The electoral commission, as you know, is appointed by the president. The courts of law have recommended amendments of the electoral reforms and even the electoral commission, but all those reforms have never been taken on board. The parliament, the executive, the judiciary are all fused. There's no separation of powers. So we're talking about countries representative of Uganda that have been under siege. You know, there's no freedom, there's no democracy. And so expecting a free and fair elections, expecting results that reflect the will of the people in such a kind of environment is just unrealistic. So people have gotten to a point where they are under duress. And here we have the militarization of all institutions, especially the police, and calling the words of William Madama, some general, who said that there's a reason why the military and the police are separated. The moment you fuse the military and the police, which military is supposed to fight the enemies of the state, the police is supposed to serve and protect the people, when they are fused, then most times the people become the enemies of the state.
I see.
So we are enemies of the state because we are people speaking out. And then we cannot expect free and fair elections. The people are under siege. The military has taken over. It's an authoritarian regime. And so we cannot expect an outcome of an election that reflects the will of the people.
Are you suggesting that you do not have the right to own an opinion?
There's no freedom of expression, association, or assembly. Yeah. So you can have your personal opinion, but where do you express it?
I see.
So social media has come in to help. So we hope that as we continue using the social media, since we are not, it's not easy for us to go on the street. You can't protest, you can't demonstrate. So social media becomes an avenue. So the birth of IT and communication helps us to at least be able to voice our impressions. But at the same time, one of the things that we can recommend is actually international pressure to some of these leaders that are leading with impunity, and whereby we really need to come around the table and have a national dialogue on our destiny and on our future, because going through emotions of election after elections that are meaningless is just a waste of resources.
Very interesting. What about you, Richmond? How do you do it in the Republic of Ghana? You seem to have credible elections.
Well, I think first and foremost, we've gone through the whole cycle of dictatorship before, and I think Ghanaians have realized that there's no point being under those conditions anymore, because it never helped us, right? When Nkrumah was overthrown, there have been cycles of dictatorship. So when we adopted the 1992 Constitution, I think we've come to the realization that we cannot do that things the old way and expect to get different results, right? So this is not also to say that we don't have challenges of our type of democracy we are practicing, but we believe that this is the only way out, at least for now, for us to move on developmentally and to catch up with the rest of the world. So that one in itself is helping. And I think most important, you've got leaders starting from Jerry who have respected the laws governing elections, right? Party lost and they handed over to Kufuor. Kufuor's party lost and they handed over to the later Tamils, and now onto Nana Akufo-Addo. So I think these leaders have by and large accepted the fact that these are the rules of the games we have to play with, and we have to accept it. And I'm also pretty sure that Ghanaians have become very conscious that, like, you can't just hold on to power or say you're going to change the constitution. I think that is history for us now. So those are some of the key things that's holding us together, and I think other countries should be able to learn from it.
Very interesting. What about you, Professor Yetunde?
In terms of, elections, we have seen on a continent where, electoral fraud has, in a sense, threatened the legitimacy of democracy in many of these countries. Nigeria, for instance, of course, has also gone through its bouts and stigma sometimes with what we call electoral fraud. But what we do need is, one, we rely a lot on independent electoral commissions to also give their opinions and assessments. I think that's extremely important. And when there is what we call any form of electoral fraud or any form of electoral manipulation in any form, I honestly believe that then leads to what we call the rise in constitutional coups. If you are able to manipulate or in some way have any form of non-free and fair elections, that means that whoever is going to be in power will then find some form of a way to manipulate the Constitution to then extend their time. So there is a link between there. We have to ensure that if we want to have what we call a flourishing democracy or a legitimate democracy, we first have to start with electoral, with free and fair elections, and then we have to address the issue of constitutional coups. That is also threatening the basis of democracy in many African countries. And I hope in the year 2020, when countries decide to do constitutional referendums, it is done in a way that encapsulates the entire population and is not done for the personal gain of one elected leader.
Now, you mentioned the need, of course, for an independent electoral commission. How do you actually go about the business of getting one? Because a lot of those institutions tend to be essentially merely independent in name, but they're in fact controlled by the incumbent president, especially in many countries. The ruling party and the state are not separate. They are fused.
Right. And I think that's one of the difficulties that we are seeing, that a lot of these supposedly independent electoral commissions are really under the authority and the directions of the incumbent president. And so there has to be some form of a process where we pick individuals who possibly may have some form of 50-50% of coming from various political parties or those who have certain term limits that still do, you know, go past the incumbent president, there has to be some form of a process or a mechanism to ensure that there is no partiality or no bias in the members who are part of this commission. And I think that's one of the greatest things that, you know, that has to be done in government. And hopefully they find a way to address that issue and choose people who are not going to be who are not going to be partial, who are not going to be biased, who are not going to have some form of loyalty or favoritism to any person who is running for office or who was already in office but is there to really carry out the duties and the responsibilities of running a free and fair election.
Joel, what about you? What do you think, if you had to talk to me from the deepest bitter part of the bottom of your Ugandan heart and soul, what do you think needs to be done and must be done in order to deliver for a lot of these African countries, really, an election whose results reflect the will of the people?
You know, Shaka, Africa is at different stages of development. Now, there are some things that we have started getting right, some things that we are getting wrong. You talked about, you posed the question, how do you get an electoral commission that that is independent when the people choosing are those, the ones that are in power? So we have not yet at least sort of managed to be able to sort of smooth that transition. But with every election that comes, you find that people are getting increasingly engaged. I'm actually very confident that as time goes on, we shall get those systems right. We're seeing it in Ghana. We're seeing it in South Africa. So what I'm saying is that there are a number of other places where actually you do have electoral system, commissions. Let's take Kenya in 2017, where it was the electoral commission that actually ordered a rerun of the presidential election. And so what I'm saying is that, and that had never happened before in East Africa. So what I'm saying is that we have a few steps forward, we have many steps back, but I think over time, and please remember the point I made before, when the people are ready, there is nothing to stop the people. Mm-hmm. We've seen it in Sudan, we've seen it in Zimbabwe, we saw it right across North Africa. Yes, they will have military opposition, maybe even sort of gunning them down. But I'm very secure in the fact that when the people decide that actually this leadership is not what we want, they do make a change.
You mentioned Kenya and you talked about how the Electoral Commission made history. You probably actually meant the Supreme Court of...
Sorry, you're, okay, right, yeah. So, yeah, I'm saying eventually, but what I'm saying is that the commission, and there was a process, my apologies, but there was a process that actually led to a rerun of an election, something that we had never seen before.
But that is...
So what I'm saying is, for example, you have three...
branches of government, which in effect, each of them is independent of the other. They are equal in power, and essentially, what they do is they check and balance one another. But you have a situation in many countries where, on paper, yes, you do have an independent legislature. Mm. On paper, you do have an independent judiciary system. And then, of course, you have the executive. But in reality, the executive controls pretty much the other two branches of government.
You're absolutely right, Shaka. But what I am saying is that as time moves on, those things will change. There's nothing you can do if the people who are picking the other branches of government and making sure that the personnel that go into those offices are those that are loyal to them. However, I'm saying that increasingly what we're going to see and what we're going to, is that as societies develop, they will be demanding the freedoms to have equal parts in those other institutions that govern the country.
I see. Well, you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. So please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you. We appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can watch our show there and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
The next Straight Talk Africa. Slavery, racism, and colonialism fueled the emergence of Pan-Africanism, a movement that connects blacks in Africa and the diaspora. Reflections on the significance of Pan-Africanism on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today, we are discussing events that are likely to shape Africa in 2020, and our guests are Catherine Kanavahita Aguma, a fellow at the National Endowment for Democracy and Executive Director of the Development Network of Indigenous Voluntary Associations in Uganda. Richard Danso, a doctoral candidate and teaching associate at the Department of Political Science of Howard University here in Washington. And in New York, we have Yetunde Edubesan Omede, Professor of Global Affairs and Politics at Farmingdale State College. And from London, we have Joel Kibazo, a former senior executive with the African Development Bank. Well, again, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the four of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. You know, we talk about, we listened, of course, to Joel talking about how we need to be a little bit, perhaps, patient. Africa will get it. It will get it right. But one of the, I think, one of the keys, really, of a free society is democracy, whether we like it or not. The only way people can get social, economic, and political justice is to have the right to express themselves. But is it really possible for people to do that if they are not reasonably well informed? What about the need, for example, for civic education, Katharina?
I totally disagree with Joel about waiting and being patient and letting things happen naturally and that we are at different stages. I think human rights, democracy principles are universal.
Mm-hmm.
We are in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot say some people in this certain world deserve this and others in this other world can wait for
justice
many
is
years.
Universal.
It's universal.
Fairness really, is universal.
Yes, Ghana is telling us for them it's history. Yeah? Never again will they have the issue of term limits removed from their constitution. Yeah. So we want to talk like that as Africans. Why should we get a road deal all the time?
And in fact, they had more military coups than a lot of African countries on the continent.
Exactly. So civic education is very important. People need to be conscientized.
And how do we get civic education? Because obviously it doesn't seem to be in the interest of governments of the day to provide that important, ingredient, that important value to their own people, because frankly, the people in power feel comfortable when majority of their people are ignorant.
Yes, they ride on the ignorance of the people. And so we have to find a way. We have to find a way. And also it looks at the issue of, again, I go back to Uganda, because we've never had a peaceful transfer of power from one president to another. These are wasted 57 or so years since independence.
Since October 9th, 1962.
The cost is immense, where people have died during wars and coups and property lost and no investments. And we've been laid behind because of all this confusion with leadership. And so we have to bring a stop to this trend of no, without a peaceful transfer of power. We have to bring, to draw the line. And so people need to be aware to connect the dots that the plight, the poverty, the circumstances in which they find themselves in, it links to a question of governance. So I feel that civic education, education in schools, should be able to empower the Ugandans to know that, and other people of Africa, to know that we had revolutionaries before who fought against the colonialists, people who like Mandela who sacrificed a lot to set free, to fight apartheid, people again from the diaspora who were able to fight slavery and get their rights. So as Africans, we need to also push and fight so that we can also be free and empowered to realize that our continent is actually the most wealthiest in terms of resources and minerals. We are the richest. Shaka, that's the irony.
And yet
we are the poorest, and yet we are the richest.
We are the richest.
Exactly.
We have actually been in the business of helping other countries become superpower.
Exactly.
Look at China, for example, the People's Republic of China. Some of you, like me, were growing up when China, the transportation of choice, was a bicycle.
Really?
Every Chinese used pretty much wear the same cloth, men and women. But you look at China now, it is the factory of the world. And why is it the factory of the world? Because of us.
Exactly.
Where does it get the oil, for example? It gets it from Nigeria. It gets from other African countries. Where does it get copper, cobalt, coltan?
DRC.
Where? Why can't we get it? Why can't we get it, Richmond?
Well, I think part of the whole problem is the way the international system has been structured also, and the fact that our so-called leaders have been part and parcel of our problems, right? So we are caught in this web where it's so difficult to have any alternative, right? Because, take an example, is when Europe was even developing, right? When all these major powers to compete with, right? But we find ourselves in a situation where Africans are trying to develop, and there's all these powers with the United States, Europe, China, India, all coming in and trying to get everything from Africa. So I think the issue is more complicated and complex than just looking at it from why are we not developing? Why not? Because there are just so many factors to it, and that is just one aspect.
But Richmond, I'm really surprised, because the last time I checked, you are a political scientist. You are doing your PhD, and at the same time, you are teaching students about politics.
Yes.
And you just talked about leaders. Are you sure that the type of people in the State House that we are talking about are really leaders, or are they rulers?
Well, I mean, that is open to interpretation. I think they call themselves leaders, right? But as to whether they are doing the work leaders are supposed to do, that's a different ballgame altogether, I mean, to answer that question, right? But I think the issue goes beyond, sometimes I think about it, I think it just goes beyond also the leadership, right? And the kind of country we want to build for ourselves as Africans, and the kind of pressure the indigenous Africans are also going to put on the leader. Because think about it, our leaders are corrupt, admittedly. But from whose society are they coming from? Which people benefit from the corruption one way or the other, right? So let's take a typical example of...
So do you believe in the saying that no society, for example, gets a leader that it desires, rather you get a leader that you deserve?
To a large extent, yes, because, I mean, there'll be some instances where you have people who come out of the blue and they will not reflect the true identity of the people in the society. But to a large extent, if the society is corrupt, obviously the people coming out of society who are going to lead the country are going to be corrupt, one way or the other. So to a large extent, I do subscribe to that ideology. And I think it's high time us as Africans also have to look ourselves within and see what and how we are contributing to building this kind of leadership on the continent. I think it's high time we look at that.
Very interesting. Let me come to you, Professor Yetunde. What about you? The need for civic education. Is it possible, frankly, to get all these things we are talking about without people, people who are adequately or reasonably informed, so that in fact they are in a position to make informed decisions or choices?
Well, I'm an advocate for civic education starting at a younger age. I think it's more beneficial to a country if they start to, you know, invest in civic education, especially earlier on in young adults and children's lives. So we're talking about secondary school, even sometimes even primary, of having an understanding of the government, having an understanding of citizenry, having an understanding of the roles and responsibilities of the citizens and the elected leaders. That's not something that should happen in the adult phase of someone's life. It's something that should happen earlier on, so there's a culture of civic engagement. It's not about just teaching civic engagement. It's about creating a culture and understanding of civic engagement. And that must, the only way that that can be achieved is if it is embedded in the educational institutions throughout Africa. And so that means that in your primary education, in your secondary education, in your tertiary education, there must be civic education that goes along as the individual is growing, so that they have a better understanding of how they themselves can engage in the electoral process, how they can engage as a citizen in government, what their rights are, what their what is expected of them, and on the other hand, have an understanding of, okay, what should I expect of an elected leader? What is it, the rules and regulations that they too should abide by? I think that's extremely critical. So it's about creating a culture of civic education, and that should start earlier on in an individual's lives. And the only way that that can be accomplished is through the institutions of education in African countries.
That sounds rather very complicated, because let's face it, at the end of the day, it is not going to be the individual Africans that are going to demand that. Isn't that an obligation of a government, of the state?
No, actually, I mean, at the end, it's actually not that. It sounds difficult, but it's actually not that difficult. If we're talking about curriculum development and we're stating that there are certain areas of curriculum development that every child must have, whether they're going through a private institution or a public institution, I think that should be readily available. And again, it should be a concern for the population as a whole. So, of course, we know that curriculum, right, that may be state-run, that may be privatized, however it may be, but then again, it's still the duty and responsibility of the institutions of education to prepare individuals to now go out into the community and to be upright citizens. I always say that one thing is that when we talk about corruption, we look at the economic impact of corruption, but we don't look at the socialization of corruption. And the socialization of corruption actually happens in institutions that are supposed to curb the same behavior. If we look at institutions of education, these are the moral pillars, almost as powerful as the government, that shape society. They're the ones who teach and help to mold the next generation. So if there is a lag in the institutions of education, if there's corruption even in institutions of education, if there's bribery, if there's no information on civic engagement, then what type of individuals are we actually producing in society? These will be the same individuals who will then run for president, who will then assume positions in our judicial sector, who will also assume positions in our public and private sector. And so if they lack the information and the knowledge of how to be ethical, how to have an understanding of civic engagement, how to have an understanding of what is right and what is wrong in and out of the workplace, then, to be honest, we have a huge issue. So we have to actually take a look at the institutions of education if we want to achieve all of the things that we are talking about in the continent of Africa.
Professor Yetunde, you introduced a very interesting element here. You talk about corruption. Is there anything, frankly, that is more of corruption than, for example, rigging an election, seizing power with an AK-47, and saying that you have done it to liberate people, when in fact, at the end of the day, you have actually done it to liberate your stomach and the stomach of perhaps your family and friends?
Yeah, these are all examples of corruption. These are all examples of state capture. These are all examples of these are what we call the ailments of it. To be frank, so when a country has high levels of corruption, you are going to have examples of this. It's going to affect every area, and so that's how we look at systemic corruption. Right, it affects every sector. It debilitates the country from actually working in a way that it should. And the unfortunate cost about it is that it's the human cost that actually matters. It's really not the economic cost, but it's the human cost that corruption has and the impact that it has on human lives. And we tend not to focus on that. But to be honest, corruption can kill. We can see that in healthcare delivery. We can see that in maybe lack of police and security. We can see that in every single area. So for me, I think the most important thing is looking at human security and looking at how corruption impedes and impacts human lives. And it's not only peculiar to African countries. I want to make that clear. This is something that goes on in every single part of the world. And we like to cast that shadow on African countries. But the thing about it is that it's not only peculiar to African countries, but again, we do have high levels of corruption in our countries.
What about you, Joel? We can talk about the launching of the ECHO. We can talk about the introduction of the Continental African Free Trade and all that kind of stuff. But is it really possible for us to benefit from that, or for our people to benefit from that, without coming up with a system that reflects social, economic, political justice for all?
Well, Shaka, let me just say this, that I think the discussion so far has been very much it has taken the form of what we would all want to see and what we hope Africa would be. What I was talking about and what I tend to reflect on is what the reality is on the ground, and therefore, how do we proceed from that point of view? So, for instance, one of the things we haven't talked about is the technology. When we talk about civil education so that people can know what their rights are and therefore be able to demand their rights and also fight corruption, if you have a government that actually introduces that curriculum in schools, that's not going to be allowed. One of the things that I actually find liberating is technology. Because with technology, we are able to circumvent the systems that have been put in place in our countries to ensure that we do not get the right information. And therefore, if, as time goes on, as we increasingly, you're able to acquire that information that enables you to ask the questions that you should be asking and the demands that you can make upon those who are governing you, and then be able to say, this is what we want, this is what should have happened, why is it not there? So, and if it isn't, and we start getting a critical mass, this will change the continent. But the notion to think that just because we want civic education, therefore the people who have been in power for such a long time have never introduced it, and oh yes, they're going to sort of bend over and be able to introduce it, I think that's a fallen thought, and really it's not going to be reality. Let's deal with what the reality is on the ground and see how we can circumvent what we're not getting, how we can get it into the systems and get it to our people, and therefore be able to move ahead.
Very interesting. Catherine, what about the issue of amending constitutions or changing constitutions in order for the individuals in the State House to essentially hang on to power for personal and political benefit, really? I'm not saying, in other words, that one should not amend or change a constitution, because the last time I checked, a constitution is essentially a living document. It is not carved out of stone, and therefore it should, in fact, and can be changed, especially if it is a reflection of the need for the people, but not the individual. But so far, when you look across the continent, it looks like there has developed a disease in Africa of individuals wishing to amend the constitutions so that they can stay in power. It used to be that people would say individuals change constitutions to stay in power, perhaps because they have committed a lot of crimes to the extent that they fear that there's nobody or nothing can guarantee their lives once they are out of power. But when you go to West Africa and look at an individual like the president of Ivory Coast, Kudiva, Alassane Ouattara, a man with a PhD in economics from one of the best institutions of learning in America, the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League, a man who worked for the International Monetary Fund here in Washington, D.C., for many, many years, to the extent that he even became the deputy director of the IMF. This man is trying to change a constitution. What does he really want? You also have a man called Alpha Conde of Guinea-Conakry, another incredibly highly educated man, a man who used to teach, if I remember correctly, at the Sorbonne, one of the best universities in French-speaking Africa, and in fact, not French-speaking Africa, in French-speaking countries, and in fact, in the world, the University of Paris, Sorbonne. This is a man who also is in the process of changing the constitution. What is it there in power that these individuals really somehow cannot do what they are supposed or required to do by their oath? Because once you get sworn into office as the president, the last time I checked, you swear to defend, protect and preserve the constitution. Any particular reason why we do not have strong institutions that are very difficult for an individual to undermine?
That's very tragic. the examples you've given and what's happening on the ground with presidents changing constitutions on their whims is very sad. And I think we go back to the Bible and remember how Jesus was betrayed for money.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of this is about power and wealth. And we are told that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So when these leaders have power and they have so much money, and the hangers on, those who've been given jobs, they cannot expect change. They get used to that kind of lifestyle, and they feel the entitlement and the impunity, and they want to maintain the status quo. And so they do everything to make sure that they remain in power and they remain with the money.
Really?
It's unfortunate, regardless of how deep and how they're sinking their countries.
Mm.
So again, you look at Africa as a continent, and you look at the wealth we have and the challenges we are going through, and I recall the words of Nkrumah, that Africa will never be free or independent until we have United States of Africa. He was talking about Pan-Africanism and uniting of Africa. The whole of Africa is comprised of five countries. A continent can fit in America, it can fit in Europe, it can fit in China, it can fit in India and Japan, all together, yeah?
Interesting.
And yet, when you come to the global scene to negotiate for trade, you realize that small countries that are so landlocked and so meager in their GDPs cannot negotiate with China around the same table.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally.
So bottom line is Africa needs to unite.
Thank you. Let me come to you, Richmond, ask you another issue, the issue of health care. It's a very huge issue on the continent. The power elite, political elite, in most African countries, they even go for medical checkup to India, to Europe, South Africa, if they go very near, but not in their own countries. A man like former president of Zimbabwe and late, of course, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, you know that he died in Singapore. In Zimbabwe, as we talk today, an average individual Zimbabwean cannot even afford penicillin. Any particular reason why we have people who lead us and really hate their people?
Well, I think part of the issue is how our governance is structured and how it alienates the ordinary African from governance, right? So things happen, the leaders live in a different world and citizens also live in a different world, right? So as far as they can afford healthcare outside the country, knowing very well that the kind of health service provided in their country is not up to task, then they're obviously going to fly outside the country to seek healthcare. I think the most important thing is for Africans to demand for these things. And that's why I kind of disagree with Joel on that, that we have to win. We have to demand for it now and hold our leaders accountable and hold them to task because we can no longer wait. Right.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. And on that note, our guests today were Catherine Kanabahita Aguma, Richard Danso, Yetunde Odubiseni Omede, and Joel Kibazo. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.